Welcome to Cloudlandia,
Mr. Sullivan.
But where do the files go? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, top secret files. They remain top secret.
Yeah. Yes, the party knows all.
That's so funny. Well, welcome to Cloudlandia. Where are you right now?
More and more. More and more we're in it. We're more and more, week by week, day by day. We're more and more in Cloudlandia.
I agree with you. I'm considering immigrating.
Well, you know, I always think that the real big opportunity is the courier service between the two. That's actually what we're doing. We're currying their thoughts between the mainland and Cloudlandia.
I think you're absolutely right. And that's really I've been thinking a lot about that transition from imagination to reality is really a great thing. I've been really thinking about my primary world is imagination, which is very Cloudlandia compliant. And if you start thinking about the physical, I've been using the word constraints, but I'm open to another word for it, of reality, of the mainland, is really works on reality time. There's no shape shifting. I think about imagination time. You can go backwards and forwards and in any, instantly be taking a thing from the past and projecting it forward into the future, thinking how a projected path might take. But the reality is in the mainland, no matter what vision you set up in your imagination, if it's going to happen on the mainland, will require adherence to the constraints of reality. I was thinking about it. If I decide in my imagination that I have a vision for, having lunch with you at Select Bistro on next Saturday. Now, I can imagine that because we've been there. I've got a history of it. I know I enjoy it. I can immediately recall all the times that you and I've been to Select Bistro, Le Select, and the times that we've been to Jacques, and I can recall those. I know and can anticipate that it would be delightful. But the reality is that in order for that to take place, I would have to move my physical meat robot from Winter Haven on my couch in my courtyard right now to the Le Select Bistro. And there's some physical realities to that. If we were having this conversation 150 years ago or 200 years ago, that would require traveling the 1,200 miles by foot or by horse or some way to get
train.
There.
Could do it. You could. 150 years ago, you could have done it by train.
Okay, yeah. There you go. That would be the top speed of the thing, which would still take some real time. There's no way to shortcut that. You're going by the speed of reality in that, right? And right now, if I were going to walk it at 4 miles an hour, it would take 300 hours to get there. Or the fastest way possible to get there right now would be to, take a private plane, a private jet from the airport 10 minutes from my house to the island airport, and I could probably be there touching down. I could probably be at Le Select Bistro 3.5 to 4 hours from right now if I decided to do.
Yeah, and they're open. They're open this morning. So
perfect. A little,
by the time you got here, the table would be waiting for you. Yeah, yeah.
And so it's interesting to really, because I've been thinking about that in the same thing, taking that for everything that you want to transition from imagination to reality. And writing a book is a perfect example of that, where if you're going to write a book, that your quarterly books, I think you've told me, is about a 35 hour process. Yeah. And that's as fast as, could run that.
In the world of books, that's pretty fast.
Absolutely, yeah. And is that, yeah, that 35 hours is the tip of, are you counting that 35 hours of your time or the?
Yeah, 35 hours of my time. It's several hundred hours of other people's.
You're leveraging everybody else. So it's knowing that kind of stuff and having your throughput system to get you plug into your throughput system that lets you put out a book every quarter for 35 hours. So you're talking
35 hours.
Than,
yeah.
Yeah, you're talking less than 150.
We're just wrapping up the next one, and this was quarter 32, and it was book 32. So we're on schedule because my goal was 100 books in 100 quarters. And but when the first one I did, which involved working with your team, took me a little over 100 hours to pull that off. Mm-hmm. And by probably the next quarter, we had gotten it down to about 60 hours. And then it's been incremental drop, efficiencies that you build into the system.
Yeah. And you've removed, I think we worked on you with the first three. And
no, first two.
The first two. And then by three, you had your own, your team in place.
We had our own writer, and I had my own interviewer, writer, and editor by book number three. So, but the, I was thinking the big multiplier of our times for individuals is number one, teamwork, because entrepreneurs, the vast majority of them, I mean, there's great things said about entrepreneurism here in the 21st century, but if you look at most entrepreneurs, they're kind of rugged individualists, that they're entrepreneurial in the sense that nobody's paying them a salary,
Right. Yeah. And they're in the results economy. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But when you take a look at what they've done, they really haven't created a business. They've created a job.
Right.
And I suspect in most cases, I have no, idea of this, but they're actually working harder for at the job they created for themselves than they ever worked. They worked at a job where they were working for someone else and not necessarily liking it any better.
Right. That they say, isn't that the thing where entrepreneurship is the only place where people will work 80 hours a week to avoid working 40 hours a week for someone else?
And
their boss ends up being just
as crazy. First of all, there's real meaning to what you just said in the sense that the sense of freedom is worth working an extra 40 hours a week. And I said, there's better ways of doing this. And the two multipliers are in the mainland world is teamwork with other people. And that's what I've done with the book project. Mm-hmm. One is technology. And that's really what Cloudlandia is, that, we were talking about my most recent book, the book that was last quarter's book, which was called You Are Not a Computer. And I said, it's an interesting thing, but with all the talk, and this talking has been going on for a couple hundred years about how technology destroys jobs. And I think it destroys specific jobs, but it doesn't destroy overall jobs. And because when the first technology that gave rise to that thought was actually milling, it was creating fabric, creating clothing. So it was around 1800, and 1800 was the first time that human population reached a billion. They had pretty good statistics. Most countries had census taking, and they established it as a billion. And the last two centuries, one of the most notable features has been constantly increasing technology. And so that means that if you have this amazing increase of technology over 222 years, which we have had. Gee, that billion population would have to be down to maybe about 500 million, right? 500 million? I mean, if they don't have a job, they're not eating, and so they're not existing.
But it also created
the world population is 8 billion now, you know, and most of them are working. So it's been just the opposite, that increasing technology creates increasing jobs, increasing jobs. Well, and actually, new jobs.
New opportunities. Yeah, completely new. Like, there's many people that are working in jobs that weren't even in existence 25 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you go that far, you know, you look at it that so many people, the biggest
companies. How many podcasters back then?
Not many.
Podcasters back then.
No. And so all of that, every advancement creates new opportunities. I remember the talk when I was researching Cyrus McCormick, the guy that invented the Reaper, you know, and it was credited along with the telephone and the railroad as the three biggest things of the 19th century, I guess the 1800s, that paved the way for the industrialization. You know, we shift from an agricultural society to an industrial society because it freed up people out of the fields into the factories.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, the number that you gave me when you told the Cyrus McCormick story, that one person with a horse and a reaper could equal the work of 18 people, 17.
Yeah, 14
17
men.
Or 18?
14 men, yeah.
14, okay.
14 men.
So, and immediately people think, well, those 14 were unemployed. And I said, well, it'd be interesting to put some thought to that, because actually probably a third of those people saw what had happened and they went out and they got land and they got McCormick Reapers, did the same thing. So actually they did it, and others became McCormick dealer. McCormick
Reaper dealers.
Reaper
dealers, right. Exactly.
Reaper dealer, yeah. A Reaper dealer. What do you do? Oh, what do you do for a living? I'm a Reaper dealer. Yeah, and it's like human beings can't respond creatively to something new. It's that whole basis is always based on, you know, the way humans are. Humans can't, they don't have enough sense to see what's going on around them, and they can't see what just happened. And because, you know, they don't have a mind that can actually just adjust to circumstances and take advantage of new opportunities. You know, and it's always based that terrible things are going to happen to the human race because the human race is incapable of reacting to anything new. I mean, it's a foolish thought.
Yeah. But you look, I mean, that's, yeah, everything adapts, right? It's funny you say people might become dealers, you know, Reaper dealers, but that was, you know, on the back of it, that was when I first discovered it, the first thought about the compelling offer versus the convincing argument. A convincing argument is, hey, you could do the work of 14 men, but a compelling offer is, hey, why don't I let you use the Reaper for the heart for the season here, and you could pay
and
me
you can pay me
harvest.
At the end.
Yeah, maybe from the harvest. And that was a compelling offer, because everybody was convinced that it was a good thing. They just couldn't afford it, you know?
Yeah.
So that paved the way.
Yeah, I think probably, you know, to put your two, you know, argument and offer together, that the final step of a convincing argument has to be a compelling offer.
Yes, and you need most. In order for it to be a compelling offer, they have to fundamentally be interested in the argument in a way that if it's, you know, if there's no argument that if they're not convinced that this, that the Reaper's going to be a benefit for them. It's an interesting, like, chicken and egg sort of situation, you know? It's, you have to still present the convincing argument that does make sense, but the compelling offer is what gets into action, you know?
Yeah, from a marketing standpoint, we don't think convincing arguments attract attention.
No.
So I think it's probably a compelling offer. And they say, oh, tell me all about it. And you bring on the convincing argument. And then just to get them to take action, you top the first compelling offer with another compelling offer.
Yeah, that's the model. So first of all, we do it. So the first four profit activators in our 8 profit activator model are selecting a single target market. So you're in that harmonizes with your idea of always be the buyer. You're doing the select. I have to outline for people or go through this process that this is different than positioning yourself to be selected, which is what most people are thinking when they're doing advertising. They're thinking, I want to cast a wide net so that anybody that could possibly be interested in what we do will be able to select us, right? Being, you know, doing the selecting is picking who you're, you know, a great place to start is thinking about your largest check and thinking about who's your ideal client, and then you go out and select them. And now the compelling and convincing where I look at those, and you're exactly right, it's that three-step process of compelling your prospects at first just to raise their hand and say,
and pay attention to you
in that. Yes, pay attention. So you do it in a way that is compelling to them. I was using an example. There's a great series of books, and one of them is Read This If You Want to Take Great Photographs. That's the name of the book, the title of the book. And he's also got in that series a book called Read This If You Want to Take Great Photographs of People. And then Read This If You Want to Take Great Photographs of Places. So the way I say it to people is, if you've got a company, you've got services that you offer to photographers, and you've got, you know, training courses or equipment or any of the things that support people in their photography endeavor, rather than making a convincing argument that, hey, our cameras are the best for taking photographs of people, you first of all have to just get in front of people who are potentially interested in taking photographs of people. That's the end result, right? It's the thing that they really want. So having a book like that, getting people to raise their hand, that's compelling them to turn from being an invisible prospect into a visible prospect, because now you pulled them out of the woodwork. We've used this example so many different ways. In Toronto, I worked with a party rental company, and convincing people to choose you for their party rental need is an uphill thing. And I was asking them about who'd be their dream client? What would be their largest check? And they said an outdoor wedding is like the big win. Get the tents and the generators and everything that goes with it. Almost everything they have gets used for an outdoor wedding. But trying to convince people to choose you as a party rental company for the outdoor wedding is an uphill climb. So we, rather than making that convincing argument, you know, McLean Party Rental since 1963, serving Toronto, so, you know, all these things that build up what you think would be a convincing argument to choose you over other options, is to put all that aside and just realize people who are about to have a wedding are invisible prospects. You can't get a list of them, but you can build a list of them by compelling
what they want. And the other thing is they don't do it all the time.
Right. That's why. Exactly.
I mean, the bride and the groom aren't doing this every 3 months, you hope.
So we put together a directory of 100 great places to have an outdoor wedding in Toronto. And that was what we would advertise. And when people respond and ask for the outdoor wedding,
because that was really the really big decision.
Yes.
Where is it going to be?
That's exactly right. And you get right up to the front of the line as far as the priority of decisions. And now you're in contact with somebody who's a visible prospect with a real timeline, probably, 6 to 24 months of planning or time. And you're the only party rental company that knows this ahead of time. You've got a list of them. So that was a compelling thing, because it's what they're interested in. You're tapping into the jet stream that way. And then we're able to convince them that going with McLean Party Rental would be the big win. It's because of all then it makes sense when they start to get to choose. But
yeah, it's really interesting. I was just in workshop last Thursday with somebody who's been in coach for 31 years. So I've seen him at a minimum, I've seen him every quarter for 31 years. And then with the new Zoom connector calls, that probably is double. It's double that now. But we were just chatting because he had moved to Toronto in the 1970s with his father. His father had a printing operation, retail printer, he would, but because of the language laws in Quebec, he had moved to Toronto. And so he was starting into a new market in Toronto and everything like that. But he did well enough that he could, he could be attracted to Strategic Coach and, he saw this as an investment. So the first day I sat down, the workshop hadn't started, and I sat down next to him. And I asked him what he did, and he says, printer. And I says, boy, you must have been a really evil person in your last life that this is the punishment in this life. And I said, I don't think there's an industry in the world where you get commoditized to death as a normal daily experience, and everything. And I said, I think printing's very important. And I said, we do a lot of printing. And for only as technology increases, you're only going to get more commoditized. And he really took me seriously. So I'm going to make a very long story very short. And I'm just going to say that today he's a marketer. He's an innovative marketer. And he lives in Toronto, but all of his customers are in New York City, mostly Manhattan, or maybe a couple of the other cities. And what he does is he has a real gift for designing very innovative envelopes just for direct mail. And a lot of our listeners will not appreciate this fact, but it's absolutely true that to this day, the single most effective form of direct marketing is the mail system. The mail system, when you send out a piece of mail, that has much bigger rate than any other form of communication. Okay. So anyway, but he creates these very innovative, and he's gotten them patented. So he has a patent. And now he has, I think, 5 of the biggest financial corporations in the United States as clients. And he designs programs for their direct mail campaigns for credit cards or other services that they offer, and these all require printing, and he's the only printer that they can go through.
His ideas. He does the brokering or whatever.
If you buy this, you want this unique proprietary idea for your thing, I get all the printing. And on any particular project, the amount of money he makes off that project is 10 times what he would make in a year and 31 years ago without a bid. There's no bids, no bids. So he doesn't do it. So what he's done is that what they don't actually want printing, what they want is new customers. So
the result.
He had to approach it a completely different way. And the other thing is, right now, you know, he lives in Toronto, but all the money is generated in the United States. And when I looked Friday morning, the exchange rate is $1.38 right now. So he's getting $1.38 to buy, you know, a dollar of printing and like that, you know. So the interesting thing is he's not talking to them about printing. He doesn't even, the subject of printing doesn't come up until they say, well, how soon can we get the project out there? And he says, well, we'll have to look at the printing schedule here. So let's just look at the dates here. And there's no discussion about who the printer is going to be. He's the printer.
I love that. I just got
He isn't a printer. He uses print shops in Toronto, you know, to use it. And they do absolutely nothing to not have him want them as their printer, you know, because jobs are so big, you know. So anyway, so going back to the start of the podcast, you were talking about imagination, you know. All failure of business and all failure of employment is a failure of imagination.
I'd love to hear that unpacked.
Well, what your compelling offer, you know, 10 times more persuasive than a convincing a convincing argument. The one factor you're taking into consideration there is, what does it look like from the other person's point of view?
Right. Yes. And that's really, that's the big win, is if you can, you know, instill in their imagination your vision for their outcome, that they get compelled by that. That's really the thing. Everybody wants the outcome. And we're really in a point now where the, you know, when we were talking about the VCR formula, vision, capability and reach, that all of the elements of those things now, just like that marketplace in China, the electronics marketplace, are available. There's no revolutionary new electronic componentry that needs to be invented, right? That's not, we're not trying to solve any of the hardware problems. All of that's available and commoditized. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I kind of look at commoditized has always had sort of a negative connotation if you're a business owner, that it's trying to, you know, then of course the margins are going down, this competition, there's more options. But if I'm looking at, if you're a visionary, the commoditization of capabilities is a winning thing. And I just use, when I'm talking about commoditized, meaning available for sale or available for you to actually to either purchase or partner or acquire those capabilities. But that's, I mean,
yeah, you know, I think you know, I've looked at it from both ways, because I think that there's a difference between automation and commoditization, you know. In other words, that under your term of reach, you know, you're not commoditizing something to have reach. You're putting something in the hands of people who can instantly put your product offering and your product itself into the hands
of millions. Yeah, but I look at, in a lot of ways, reach is, the way I would think about reach as a commodity is that it's available for hire. You can, right now, you can buy from Facebook access to their newsfeed, you know, and show your ad specifically to any segment of their audience that you choose, you know, and you don't have to build that audience. You don't have to do anything. You get right in front of them. YouTube, that all of those eyeballs that access to that reach is commoditized in that you can buy it. You can show ads to specific people who watch specific things, even to the point where you can show, you can reach an audience on YouTube of people who were just 4 hours ago searching on Google for something. You know, somebody searches for red wagons on Google, and then 4 hours later, they're surfing on YouTube watching, you know, cat videos, and comes you with, hey, are you looking for a red wagon? Come on down to Red Wagon Village, you know, get right in front of your exact audience that you need to get in front. And so all of that is, you know, that used to be what even the postal service that you talk about is a commoditization of reach. You have to pay. So that's where either capital or organic is how, you know, building that reach. Mr. Beast, the advantage that he has is that he's got 100 million subscribers that he can access for free because he's built up all of that audience, you know. But they get monetized because you can show ads on a Mr. Beast video if that's your target audience, right? Mm-hmm. There's just such recognizing your assets all across the VCR formula is, you know, vision assets is intellectual property of knowing what to do. Capability assets are equipment, people, technology, tools, you know, manufacturing, anything that you need to actually organize to be able to do something. And then reach assets can be access to your audience, to your clients, to your stuff. So you can participate in the VCR formula with whatever assets you have. You know, you could be a vital part of that. Mm-hmm. Nothing happens unless somebody's got a vision for it.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that I think happens, and, you know, I'm constantly, this is, you know, constant thought process going on inside my brain. And I said, what is it that when opportunity is staring someone in the face, they don't take the opportunity when the opportunity completely matches what they want, you know, what they say they want. Okay. And what I've realized is that they have other conditions that they're not putting on the table. And one of them is it can't disturb my overall life at all. You know, if you say you're going to take my opportunity up 10 times, that's not going to come without a price.
Right.
Okay. And I think that more and more, for example, something that we've been onto and it's been really dramatic has to do with getting our clients to renew into the program at the end of a program year. Okay. Mm-hmm. So always, you know, it's another sale to a certain extent. I mean, some people it's a given, you know, they're just automatically going to sign up. But, you know, I would say that it's a given that certain people are not going to sign up.
Okay. Yeah.
And I would say, you know, I don't have any numbers that come to mind right off the bat, but our success really depends upon the percentage of the total number of clients at the end of each year that have to be re-engaged or resold with why they're doing this. And the interesting thing is you'll have entrepreneurs in Strategic Coach who just had their greatest year ever. And they say, and it's time for renewal. And they say, well, yeah, I don't know. I'm not really sure. You know, I'm not really sure I'm going to come. And they said, but you were saying it to everybody in the workshop. You were just having your best year ever. So what is it? Why wouldn't you want to continue on with that? And they said, well, you know, I got to really think about this. Okay. And I told my program advisors who are the, you know, they're the they make that sale. The program advisors are the people responsible for moving people from one year to the next by renewing. And I say, I'm going to give you a tip. It doesn't have anything to do with their business. It has to do with what's happening in their personal life. And I said, that year of extraordinary growth created pressures on them from the people that they know, because the people they know are not having extraordinary years. And so one of the things is that you're a marketer, and on the face of it, the programs you put together are a no-brainer, and yet people don't necessarily, not as many people as you think, would just immediately engage and initiate them.
Right. That's the frustration of things. Like you just said it on the head. Like, you know, on the one thing that it works. I take this approach where I look at, you know, return on relationship is one thing that we measure in the after unit of a business. So when you look at what you're describing there, is we would, if I were looking and overlaying this on Strategic Coach, I would say, okay, the after unit of your business is, I would call it everybody who's in year two or beyond of the program, and measure the percentage of revenue that comes from that, you know, relationship portfolio. The people that have successfully moved into year two, I would call that the after unit, and I would call the during unit year one of the program. They're getting it established. And then if they move into year two, the odds are much higher that they're going to stay even longer, you know? And so when we look at establishing that in people's minds, like for Strategic Coach members, and I've had this conversation with Joe Polish, that we've been talking about this idea of return on genius, where document and get people to really put a number to the tangible return on genius. So within Genius Network, the things that are going to have an impact are going to be primarily ideas, that you got an idea that you then implemented and it generated this outcome for you, or contacts that you met somebody who became a client or became a resource or became a collaboration that had a monetary gain, you know, what the payoff was. And I think ultimately that's the one of the biggest things.
Yeah.
You could show that it would be pretty compelling, where if you get people to think in lines that they are, that it's paying for itself.
Yeah.
If you look at, you've told the story of in Genius Network and the first meeting, the concept of
the first hour
of 10 times birthed in your mind. You got that idea was planted. You can go right to there and say, that was where I birthed the idea of the 10 times program. And now you set that into motion. And what has been the impact of that over, you know, the ongoing, you know, keep continuing to go? And that whole reframing the investment, and then we use that language too, as a capital investment in Genius Network, as opposed to thinking about it as a $25,000 or $100,000 expense, to frame it as I've said to Joe, setting up a 10-year context, to think of it as a $250,000 investment allocated $25,000 a year for the next 10 years to chart and measure when people reach escape velocity. Like, I could see it'd be an interesting exercise. Like,
I think that the other aspect is, in the book that we're writing this quarter is called Thinking About Your Thinking, which I think really the new state of mind that people acquire from repeated strategic coach workshops. Okay. And after a while, they don't really pay that much attention to what the world is thinking about anything. They more and more just pay attention to where their own
thinking about
brain
your
is.
Thinking.
Thinking about your thinking. And I said, you know what it is? And somebody said, you know, you're creative, Dan. You know, you're very creative. We always know you're going to have new stuff every quarter. And they said, how do you do that? And I said, well, I've heard that my brain is an independent force with a will of its own. Okay. And so what I've learned to do more and more every year is to put myself in the best possible position where I can collaborate with my own brain. Okay. Because my brain's going to do what it wants. And so instead of trying to, you know, put a leash on it and say, you can only go here, you can only go here, you can't go there and everything like that, I say, you can go wherever you want to go, but just bear in mind that I have to catch up with you every now and then. I haven't quite learned the game yet of adjusting quickly to new places where you take me. So I just want you to be patient with me. I'm working on myself to be in top-notch condition, prime condition, that wherever you go, I can go there with you and I'll benefit from the journey. You know, and that's literally the truth, how I experienced my relationship with my own brain. And people say, well, aren't you paying attention to what's going on in the world? I says, I have to tell you, I just don't have time. My brain just keeps me so busy. My brain just keeps me so busy. I wish I had the time to actually pay attention to a lot of other things, but I'm quite frankly, if I get through the day and I've done a good job of collaborating with my brain, I have to tell you, that's a great day.
Yes. That's so great.
What do you think
I love
about
that? No, I think it's fantastic. I mean, I think about this, my life, like for 25 years now, more than that now, 27 years, I started journaling in earnest in April of 1996. So, you know, 26 years of journaling, which I look at as a constant conversation with my brain, this ongoing dialogue we have, you know, is thinking about my thinking. And it's my favorite thing, you know, the thing that I just need a pen and a notebook and a comfy chair. And we're off, you know, it's effortless. And luckily I've been able to create outlets in the real world for the things. One of the real, like the things I've been really thinking about my thinking on is what I've discovered recently with Russell Barkley, the ADHD doctor, completely reframing and realizing that, you know, the folding and the exoskeleton idea, that I don't know why this wasn't more obvious to me, but I really started looking that every single good thing that's come in, everything that works in my life is surrounded by a scaffolding that externally supports it and makes it happen.
Oh yeah.
That I have been sort of resistant to that idea in a lot of ways. Like I know I'm being successful when I wake up every day and say, what would I like to do today? Because in my mind, my mistaken sort of thought was that I need space to be able to get things done. You know, like if I have all the time, then I could wrangle and focus my brain to get stuff done. But this reshaping my mind of looking at my AD as a real, I'll use the word disability as a thing of just not having executive function, meaning not the mobility to move my ideas from the imagination world, the imagination side of the equation. I'm a billionaire, in that mind level. And but moving it into the reality side requires, on some level, you know, real movement, right? And that's, I saw one of his videos where he likens it. You wouldn't say to a paraplegic, well, all you got to do is just get up and run. Just, it's right over there, you know? And as easy and seem obvious as it seems, you just got to buckle down. That's where I've been taking that approach on myself of looking at it as, I just need to buckle down and discipline myself and get myself to take action and control myself into it. When I realize it's not a matter of will, it's a truly matter of ability, you know? And that's,
yeah.
So then the job is setting up the scaffolding.
And each of us only has the ability that we have, but for there to be a maximum external result, it's going to require your ability to be multiplied by many other abilities.
And that's exactly right. So the biggest wins in my life have come from plugging into an existing executive function branch that has the ability I can plug in my ideas into an existing infrastructure that is an execution engine, or has the executive function to take things and turn ideas into results.
Yeah.
Compared to trying to and wondering, why have I continually underperformed in my ability to execute on my own ideas, on my own behalf?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's been a big thing.
Looking at it historically, I can understand why this idea didn't appear before.
And why? Because
because the number one task that really used up everybody's daily energies and their attention was just having enough to eat. And that the reason why America went through the roof, you know, if you think about even when the revolution happened, there were about 3 million Americans. That's how many people there were. When the country started, you know, and let's say Washington as first president, you're up to about 4 million. And that had happened in about a 25-year period, which is pretty good when you think about it. Their population went up, you know, by 33% in 25 years. And America was the only society where food was a given. They were able to produce their own food. They had unlimited protein, especially with hunting and, you know, animals and fishing and everything like that. And there's a pretty well established rule that in order to do work above physical work and, you know, have the leisure to do more than physical work requires an average of at least 2,500 calories a day. Okay, you have at least 2,500 calories a day. Mm-hmm. Since its birth, the U.S. has averaged basically about 3,500 calories a day. Okay, that means that over the last 200, 300 years, Americans have just had a calorie advantage that nobody else in the world has, you know.
Well, I never thought of it like that.
Yeah, and so what meant that there could be more and more mental work, okay? And one of the prime ways that mental work was used is figuring out how to reduce physical work. So we're the beneficiaries. We're sitting here in 2022, and we have just the enormous growth of over, you know, I mean, if you go right back to the beginning, 1600, so it's 2,400 years of calorie-rich humans actually creating more and more scaffolding for us outside, so that once we get an idea, it just goes boom. The idea just goes, you know, all our mental work immediately is multiplied outside of ourselves if it's actually creating value for other people. Yeah, so that's what I'm saying right there.
That's, and now, of course, if you carry that line all the way, like, you know, initially it was, that's what all the mechanical, all the industrial things, be able to create things and then to move them around the country, you're increasingly easier and easier, yep. You know, moving physical goods from, you know, the railroad opened up national distribution opportunities for companies. Yeah. Now,
quite frankly, probably one of the great multipliers for Cyrus McCormick was actually that he could get customers who would telegraph him and saying, I'd like to get in on your pay after the harvest deal. Could you send me a harvester? And that harvester on Cyrus would be packaged up, taken down to the local rail station, and within a matter of 3 days, that person would have their harvester.
Yeah.
You know? And so my sense is that he came along and he could do what he was doing because there were other technologies that were breakthrough technologies like his own that would deliver the goods. That once he had the goods, there was a delivery system for the goods.
Yeah. And now you think about, you know, if you fast forward now, we're on the cusp of where we're delivering digital products digitally to a global audience that there's zero friction, zero cost, you know, that's where we are right now. There's so much.
Yeah. And there's never any end to it. I mean, it's not like, you know, I hope we use it all up before there isn't any more.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
Yeah. And, but if we lived in the physical world, there's a very good chance of that happening. I mean, if you were strictly a mainland operation, there is an end to things.
Yeah. Well, real limits of things that we're going to face into are attention. That's the finite resource we've already got.
Yep.
I did the most recent calculations on YouTube. It would take 32,000 years of 8-hour days to consume one day's worth of uploads to YouTube.
Yeah.
So the appetite,
nobody has the goal to do that. You know what I mean?
Right. Exactly.
And you know, we calculate, you know, humans, you know, we calculate, we have the same, you know, intentionality as an oak tree or a maple tree. So it's acorn dropping season right now in Toronto. I look out there and it seems like millions of acorns all of a sudden came down over the night. And I said, but each of these was supposed to be an oak tree. And, you know, and they're all wasted. And they're all wasted. And they said, well, you know, each of the oak trees got here because one of them took root, you know, and maple trees. So the big thing about it is that what you're looking for is effectiveness, not efficiency. That you don't want every acorn to become an oak tree. Okay.
Right.
A lot of it you just want to be squirrel food.
Squirrel food. That's right.
Yeah, and everything, and so it's very, very interesting because I think that the same principles of manufacturing in the mainland world are also going to be absolutely true in the digital world. Yeah, and looks to me like Mr. Beast is like the Cyrus McCormick. You know, he's sort of
I'll keep an eye on the. So he's over 1,600 Mr. Beast restaurants right now.
Restaurant.
And, well, of locations, like other people's collaborations, let's call it. 1,600 collaborations using excess capacity capabilities in other restaurants to deliver over $100 million in revenue. And he just opened a physical location in New Jersey that's doing $30,000 a day right now.
Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't
it? Why wouldn't it? Indeed. Exactly.
Yeah. But I think he's like, he's doing in the digital world what Cyrus McCormick or Henry Ford or what they did in the mainland world.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I'm keeping an eye on is Cole, who partnered with Amazon to do all of their returns. They added 2 million customers a year. They just partnered with Sephora to open a Sephora makeup store in all of the Kohl's stores. So this idea of like Toys R Us inside of Macy's and, restaurants within restaurants, these collaborations and, looking at these capability assets, capacity, excess capacity as a immediately harvestable opportunity,
Yeah. I think there's a really interesting phenomena that's happening in the world right now, and the Japanese are actually the trailblazers on this, that because the age of global trade is actually over, it's actually been over for about 10 years now, and part of the reason is that the U.S. went basically about 60 years where they didn't protect their own economy with tariffs. Okay, so the producers in their own economy. And so everybody in the world was allowed to sell into the United States with no penalty. There was no penalty for selling into the United States. And that built up the world, but it didn't build up the United States. Actually, the U.S. basically paid a price, a sacrifice of jobs, sacrifice of communities, sacrifice of that to educate the rest of the world. But now the U.S. has decided not to do that again. It started with Clinton, and then you went Bush and Obama, and Trump was the one who announced that it was a new situation. And Biden's doing basically the same thing. Mm-hmm. And what the new deal is, you can't sell your products into the United States, but you can move your factories to the United States.
Oh, wow.
So Japan, almost their entire, and Japan has basically moved its manufacturing out of Japan. And a large amount of it has gone to the United States, like Toyota and, Mazda and everybody else. Yeah. And they're throughout, mostly in the southern United States in terms of because they only go to right-to-work states, so they don't go to union states. Okay. Mm. But think about that. As the new phenomenon.
Yeah.
Yep. You can sell to Americans, but your factory's got to be where the Americans are. And guess what? The people working in your factories have to be Americans.
Wow. That's great.
What do you think about that?
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
I mean, it just seems like that. It's so obvious.
Well, the other thing is that the states, and you're talking about everything that's not a unionized state, and it's the larger percentage of states in the United States where they are in the world, and they have their factories. Probably 25% of their expenses are just bribes. They're just bribes to get a license to, and everything else. And they say, well, here, you don't have to. You just take the bribe money and put it into creating a better factory and everything else. So I think that the U.S. is, I don't know if this, I can't think that there was anybody who saw this in 1945 and set it up, but it just happens to be turning out this way. So that's my Mr. Beast project. I'm going to follow this, and I will report back into Welcome to Cloudlandia on a satisfying basis.
I like what I'm hearing.
I'm going to report to this that I think the U.S. has come up with an entirely new way of running your economy. Anybody who's got a successful factory anywhere in the world, invite them to bring their factory and establish it in the United
States. Sharing our reach. That's really good. This is great.
Well, the other thing is, you know what the U.S. has a lot of?
Tell me.
Space.
That too.
Yeah. You could double the population of the United States and the country still wouldn't feel crowded.
Yeah, I just saw some, that if you look at, I forget what percentage of the population, 80% of the population of the United States lives kind of east of the middle of the country. If you draw a line up the middle, 80%+ of the population.
Yeah, the Mississippi River, essentially.
Yeah.
The Mississippi River. Yeah. Okay, well, we only opened up about 10 possibilities for future exploration of this
Absolutely.
Goal.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I will report back on this massive movement because I think this is one of the most extraordinary global economic innovations.
I love it.
Yep.
Always enjoyable, Dan.
Okay.
Okay. Have a great day.
Soon. Okay. Bye.